As I was saying at the end of the last tape, we were visiting in Iowa, and my greatest remembrance was at my Uncle Will Givens's place. He was running a garage selling Hudson Super 6 and Maxwell automobiles. He had a small air compressor on wheels that could wheel around and air up people's tires, for which he charged a nickel a tire. And when I was there, he allowed me to be the custodian of the air compressor bearing up tires and gave me all the nickels I collected airing up the people's tires. That made me feel real important. On a Saturday night, he loaded all of us. There was all together seven of us, including my brother and I, into the old Hudson Super 6 seven-passenger touring car. Went to another town, Clarendon, I believe it was. It was the county seat of an adjoining county. They were having a county fair, and that night, Saturday night, they were having a display of fireworks, and they were most beautiful fireworks, which my brother and I enjoyed a great deal, because we didn't get to see much fireworks in living way out in the country in the panhandle of Oklahoma. After the fireworks were over, started back to their house, home in the other county. We got out onto the Lincoln Highway just before we got out of this town of Clarendon. And as we were driving along, which it was a gravel road, practically all roads were gravel roads, and particularly this Lincoln Highway was a nice, big, wide highway, but still it was a gravel road. There was a Buick passed us, and our Aunt Fanny said, "Will, you gonna let that Buick dust you up?" And he says, "Well, we'll let them get on down the road a ways, and then we'll show them what speed is." So after we got well out of the town, out onto the highway, he started picking up the speed. Finally pulled up and got up alongside of this Buick, and the man in the Buick was pushing on the steering wheel and doing everything he could to get another ounce of power to go just a wee bit faster. But the old Hudson Super 6 had a little bit more left, and we went past him. I was sitting in the center in the front seat between my aunt and uncle, and looking right down at the speedometer. And when we passed the fellow in the Buick, we were going at that grand speed of 44 miles per hour, which to me at that time was the acme of perfection in automobiles, to be able to go that fast. The fastest I had ever traveled previous to that was on that Golden State Limited Rock Island passenger train out western Kansas, where we got on it. I timed it between mile markers on some telephone or telegraph posts alongside of the track at 60 miles an hour, and I thought that was really tearing things up to be traveling that fast on such a large thing as a train. But it was on a smooth track, and didn't have to watch out for chug holes in the road and things like that. Another great thing about Uncle Will's house was they had electricity. That was the first house I'd ever spent any time in where I could turn on the switch and get electric lights. To a boy of 9, that was quite a deal to be able to turn a switch and have a light come on without having to go through a rigmarole of cleaning lamp chimneys and lighting a match and lighting a kerosene lamp. During this period while we were in Iowa, or even about the time we left home to go on this trip, General John J. Pershing had the U.S. Army in northern Mexico trying to run down Pancho Villa, who had made raids on across the border, across the Rio Grande River into the United States, and had caused the death of several people. The Mexican government couldn't seem to cope with him, and they had agreed to let Pershing come in with some of his soldiers and try to run down Pancho Villa. Someplace in Iowa, I can't remember where, we went to a moving picture show, and one of the comedies, or the comedy probably that always run before they started the feature picture in the picture shows of those days, they had this comedy, which was an animated drawing, first one I'd ever seen, of Mutt and Jeff. They were in the army with Pershing in northern Mexico, and Mutt was a sergeant, and Jeff a buck private in the rear ranks, and they'd put them out on an observation post. Mutt put Jeff onto the observation post and started to twist it and turned it up and got him way up high where he could observe over into the Mexican lines, and they started shooting cannons at him. And one cannon ball went through and hit the observation post and cut it off, and Jeff grabbed onto a corner of a cloud and was hanging there on this cloud while they were getting another observation post up to him to where he could get down. One of my aunts there in Iowa had given me an air rifle, and when we started home it was too long to go into any of our baggage that we had along, so I was carrying it and had a sort of my mother dressed me up in a sort of a sailor suit or some kind of looking military outfit. Anyway, as I was in the depot in Des Moines when we were getting ready to leave, we had to change trains from where we'd got on in northern Iowa and Des Moines. We had to change trains, and as I was there in the depot, some fella says, "Well, son," says, "you don't look old enough to be going to the Mexican border to help out Pershing. How old are you?" I says, "I'm 9. He said, "Well, maybe you are old enough to help him out then." Speaking of speed, I am recording this as I'm traveling along in my Gran Torino automobile at 60 miles an hour, and I can truthfully say this is one of the best automobiles that I have ever owned or driven. The speedometer just went over to 90,200 miles, and I have never had any trouble except one time, not long back, I started to Corpus Christi, and 6 miles from home, the water hose from my heater back to the motor broke and ran out my water. Only trouble I've ever had out on the road, and practically none, just any time. We came home, and nothing particularly happened the rest of the summer. I started to school that fall and completed the fourth grade. In the spring of 1917, the United States got into the war in Europe, and things started to happening that we had never figured on having to experience, such as rationing of sugar. You could not hardly buy any sugar or flour, and we had to eat lots of cornbread. And we ate so much cornbread to this day. I do not care for cornbread at a meal. I started back to school in September of 1917 to Mokane District 101 in the fifth grade. And sometime later that month, quite a happening happened at our family. That was when we acquired our first Model T Ford Touring automobile, when you could get any color you wanted as long as it was black. However, this was somewhat of a special Model T Ford in that it had wheels, natural wood color, with demountable rims, and 30 by 3.5 tires all the way around. The standard Model T Ford in those days had 30 by 3.5 tires on a solid rim wheel and 30 by 3 tires in front on solid rim wheels. So that this was somewhat special. The tires that were on this car were a red top Fisk, time to retire by a red top Fisk. They supposedly were the acme of tires in those days, costing about $30 a tire. And with careful driving and not having too many punctures, you could drive these tires for possibly 4,000 to 5,000 miles before they had to be replaced. This car had been purchased by a young fellow who had been drafted into the Army, and he'd only had it about 6 months and driven it possibly 1,000 miles in that time. The top speed that it would go was about 35 miles an hour on the dirt roads, and we usually ran 20 to 22 or 3 miles per gallon of gasoline. Gasoline being quite poor, and no tax on it, costing roughly at a filling station or a pump at a garage, as there was very few thing known as filling stations in those days, that gasoline costing at the pump around 25 to 26 or 7 cents a gallon. And we had a barrel installed up on the wall in our house and bought our gasoline by the drum for about 21 cents a gallon. My father had sold a span of mules and a big red saddle horse to the Army for a grand sum of $950, and the car cost $900. Of course, in those days, Model T Fords did not have what was known as a self-starter. You had to crank them by hand, and there was an apparent knack to cranking the things. My father had a terrible time of learning to crank the thing. In fact, I, being just about 10 years old, oftentimes could get it started when he couldn't. Spring of 1918, I graduated out of the fifth grade into the sixth grade, and was ready to go into the sixth grade come September 1918. During the summer of 1918, a very startling thing happened at our house. We were sitting eating supper one evening, and the telephone rang. We were on a big party line, one wire telephone and ground, making the circuit. Anyway, our ring, two longs and a short, belled out, and my father got up from the table and answered it. He says, "Yes, sir." And he says, "No, sir, that can't be." Says, "He is 9 years old, or 10 years old, and is sitting here at the table eating right now." And he says, "Okay, sat down." He said, "That was the army calling to tell us that our son, Homer C. Givens, had been severely wounded in action in France, but that he would survive." When the army finally checked up, they notified us that they had made a mistake, that fellow was a Homer C. Givens from a little town in Georgia called Mokane. Latter part of July 1918, they extended the draft period to 35-year-old men, and my father, being just under 35, had to register for the draft, and not long later his number came up and to be drafted. And about the same time that he got his notice that his number has been drawn, he was appointed our school district Red Cross United Fund Committee to solicit donations for the Red Cross, the Salvation Army, the various other organizations that were taking up donations for a war effort. And they wanted him to visit every family in our school district soliciting. He, getting his crops in, cultivated, and thinking he might be drafted into the army, he was real busy. He selected a Sunday when probably most all the people would be home to get to do our soliciting on this Sunday. He and I started around visiting all the people on that Sunday. A week or so later, he got word that he would be deferred. However, a bachelor neighbor that had just, after registering and his number being drawn, had turned 35, he was called into the army. And he started a suit against my father for soliciting those funds on Sunday. However, it never got past anybody at all, because quick as it got to the county attorney, he threw the thing out and said that was just hogwash. A few days after the 1st of November, one evening, the general ring came over the party line. That was a ring they rang for everybody to listen, because it was something important to happen. My father got on the phone. They said the armistice had been signed and war was over. However, the next morning they put out another general ring saying that that had been a false report and the war was not over. Of course, a few days later then, it was actually, the armistice was actually signed and the war was over until 1939. February of 1919, my father came in one morning to breakfast after being out and having milked the cows and harnessed his horses, came in and says, "We've been robbed." My mother says, "What have we been robbed of?" And he said, "Somebody got all of our red top fist tires and our coils and light bulbs and a few other small incidentals off of the car." And we never did find them. By that time, red top fist tires were selling for almost $40 a tire. So my dad bought a set from a well-known mail order house. They were called Justice Tires, and guaranteed for 3,000 miles. However, the first one gave trouble at less than 1,000 miles, and we had trouble with all of them. We never did get any replacement on those tires, and none of them made the 3,000 miles. A few days after those tires were stolen, we borrowed a car from a neighbor, and we'd heard about we might find something along the line of those tires in Liberal, Kansas. We went up there and got a hold of the sheriff, and he says, "Well, yes, I know of a fellow that has an old car out east of town here with out a top on it. It's got a wagon sheet over the top of it." And he says, "I'll make a run out there and trying to find out something." He said, "I'll be back in about an hour, hour and a half." And we waited around, and the sheriff came back, and he said, "No, that fella had some grain in the back of that car. He was unloading it when I got there." About 5 years later, I was running a tractor, plowing up wheat land on a big wheat farm just south of Liberal, Kansas in Oklahoma, and a overhead valve broke on the tractor, and I took the head off and took it into Liberal, Kansas, where the fellow had bought the tractor to have them put a new valve in. And while I was standing around waiting for him to fix the head up, and I happened to see a car stolen. I didn't know it was stolen at the time until the fellow came along and claimed the thing and couldn't find it. And that led to the break of a big car thieving ring. And come to find out, the sheriff, who is still the same man that we had gone to see about our tires, was the ringleader of this. He was the main mogul of the car thieving ring, and He had several other fellows with him, and they were all tried in federal court separately. And when the judge went to pass sentence on him, I being the main witness in the trial, the judge asked him if he had anything to say before sentence was passed on him, and he said, yes, that little cotton-headed so-and-so better watch out, or when he got out. The judge says, I now pass sentence upon you to spend 35 years in the federal penitentiary at Leavenworth, Kansas, with no chance of either ever getting out on good behavior or parole or any other way of getting out until you spend the whole 35 years. Apparently, he had mellowed considerable when he got out because he didn't look me up, and or maybe I was too far away, being in South Texas at that time, about 700 miles from where he came out to. I finished the sixth grade that spring of 1919 and worked in the wheat harvest fields most of the next summer, shocking wheat and hauling wheat from thrash machines to the elevators in town. That fall, I'd been promoted to the seventh grade, and I can't remember of anything very drastic or anything happening that year in school or out of school. And finished the seventh grade in the spring of 1920, and that spent the next summer again in wheat fields, helping thrash and the wheat, and getting it to the market and plowing up the wheat land ready for the next crop. Entered the eighth grade in the fall of 1920, and I was the only one in the eighth grade in our little school. Nothing exciting happened in school that year that I can remember, or anything that wasn't very well impressed upon my mind. The spring of 1921, graduating from eighth grade, had to go to the county seat to take the eighth grade county examination to graduate from the eighth grade. And there I ran into a young fellow that was from another little country school way out in the country, and we became very good friends taking the eighth grade examination. We ate together and piled around together between examination periods. He turned out not to be the smartest fellow in the world. One examination that I remember we had to take was called agriculture, and one of the questions was to name three breeds of chickens. I had said Plymouth Rock, Rhode Island Red, and White Leghorns. While we were eating lunch that day, after finishing that exam, this boy said, well, that question on that culture there about three breeds of chickens. I said, well, that was easy. It would have been easy for you off a farm. I put down Plymouth Rock, Rhode Island Red, and White Leghorn. Oh, yeah, I couldn't think of that, so I wrote Rooster, Hen, and Pullet. I don't know whether he passed his eighth grade examination or not. Anyway, he didn't show up at the eighth grade, county eighth grade commencement exercises held not long after we had taken the examinations in the Baptist Church in Beaver City, which was the county seat of Beaver County. The speaker at this county 8th grade exam commencement was impressed me greatly. I was inherited my mother's family's big feet. There I was in the 8th grade with a pair of knickerbocker trousers, big black rib stockings above my number 9 shoes, up to my knees inside of the going under the tight band of the knickerbockers, and I was sitting right down in the front, right square in the front of the speaker, and he got along in his speech a little ways, and says, he said, people, he says, will the audience here grant me a moment's leave while I confer with my young friend down here in front of me? He motioned me to come up